From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. An apparent breakthrough in Syrian peace talks in Munich was announced in the wee hours Friday at a press conference held by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov.
What we have here are words on paper. What we need to see in the next few days are actions on the ground in the field.
This is a complicated task. There are too many stakeholders involved in military activities, and it is important to use the unique potential of the International Syria Support Group, which unites almost all countries that have some kind of leverage on those fighting on the ground.
CCTV's Guy Henderson was there for the early morning announcement and filed this report from Munich.
The U.S. Secretary of State, John Kerry, was the last of the diplomats to leave the Hilton Hotel here in Munich. He walked out of this door at just before 2 a.m. local time after several hours of talks with the International Syria Support Group. 17 countries from around the world, all of the major stakeholders. There was even representation from the Syrian opposition here as well. And there was what appears to be, and I say this cautiously, a very significant breakthrough. Just to give you the highlights of it, firstly, an immediate or almost immediate channel of humanitarian aid running into Syria. That will be overseen by a working group, which will start its work in Geneva, in Switzerland, within literally a few hours from now, and humanitarian aid we expect to start flowing into Syria, overseen by Russia and the United States, cooperating in that regard. Humanitarian aid flowing into Syria. Then number two, at the conclusion of these talks, during a press conference, Secretary of State Kerry announced that there would be a cessation of hostilities within 1 week. Again, a task force assigned, again overseen by the Russians and the Americans, that will prepare the forces on the ground, the complex web of different factions and forces battling each other through this increasingly complex civil war towards a cessation of hostilities. It's not at this stage being called a ceasefire, but a cessation of hostilities, some discussion around whether there may be a difference between those two. But certainly diplomats here seem to believe that at this stage, UN Resolution 2254 can still be on track. And just to remind you, that would be a peace deal by the middle of this year and elections by the middle of next year. Well, another significant development appears to be what the Russian foreign minister said was a new level of cooperation militarily as well. Actively cooperating in what he described as a common approach towards ISIL and also military forces operating over Syria, trying to coordinate to ensure that there aren't similar incidents to the one we saw between Turkey and Russia on two occasions in recent months. And major differences do remain between these both sides, both the US and Russia particularly here. There was no secret of that during this press conference between these two men. Kerry spoke about how Russian aggression in Aleppo, in the key city of Aleppo, had undoubtedly, he said, given Assad a stronger footing, but he said that was only short term and that in the end there should still be a political transition. Lavrov's response to that, well, was that, well, the Syrian government, in his view, had every right to take out and remove what the Syrian government and the Russian government see as an illegitimate force occupying the city of Aleppo.
Millions poured into the streets of Tehran to celebrate the anniversary of Iran's revolution in 1979. Press TV's Hamid Javani was there and filed this report.
On the occasion of the 37th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, once again, Iranians from all walks of life took to the streets in their millions to demonstrate the support for their country. These rallies are held on the 22nd of the Iranian calendar month of Bahman.
I want to prove that no matter what the enemies do, we are behind our leader and the Islamic Republic. We will never give up.
I want to say to all the people in the world, we have came because we want the support of the innocent people that are being killed by America, Saudi Arabia and Israel.
Regarding the latest atrocities committed by supporters of extremism and terrorism, we express our solidarity with our country in the face of all the insecurity in the region.
All cities and towns inside the Islamic Republic witnessed these rallies in celebration of the victory of the revolution that put an end to the monarchical rule of the U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime.
Our participation in these rallies comes a few weeks after the implementation of the JCPOA that was a major victory for our nation and that they cannot be taken for granted.
Analysts say Iranians' massive turnout at rallies demonstrates the nation's readiness to confront any foreign pressure. Iran, as a superpower in the region, is known for its high security standards and is considered essential for maintaining peace and security in the region. Hamid Javani, Press TV. Tehran.
Among those in the Iranian capital for the celebration was an American, the head of the Nation of Islam, Minister Louis Farrakhan, who recited some of Iran's history and its relationship with the United States over the past 60 years.
Iran has been through a lot, living under the Shah, but before him, Brother Mohammad Mossadegh, a man who was democratically elected, was overthrown by the CIA after he nationalized the oil in this country. He wanted the revenue of oil to benefit the people of Iran. America and Britain and others wanted the benefit of that oil. So they put someone in place that would give them access to what they wanted. I would hope that at this later stage, where you are now coming out from under sanctions that were designed by the West to destroy the revolutionary spirit of the Iranian people and cause the Iranian people to rise up against their government. But thanks to Allah, the people of Iran stood firmly with their leadership, and the sanctions only caused Iran to look deep within itself. And now those sanctions are being lifted. But Iran is stronger, Iran is wiser, Iran is more influential.
More political spectacle with Thursday's Democratic Party debate, the sixth thus far, with Senator Bernie Sanders and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton at center stage.
I voted against the war in Iraq because I listened very carefully to what President Bush and Vice President Cheney had to say. And I didn't believe
that. If I could just respond. Two points. One, Senator Sanders voted in 1998 on what I think is fair to call a regime change resolution with respect to Iraq, calling for the end of Saddam Hussein's regime. He voted in favor of regime change with Libya. I do not believe a vote in 2002 is a plan to defeat ISIS in 2016. Calling the president weak, calling him a disappointment, calling several times that he should have a primary opponent when he ran for re-election in 2012, I think that goes further than saying we have our disagreements.
One of us ran against Barack Obama. I was not that candidate.
To take a look behind the curtains at the U.S. election and the broader social landscape, we spoke with scholar and activist Professor Anthony Montero. Professor Montero's academic work is focused on Marxism and race. He's the former head and founder of the African Studies program at Temple University. We spoke with Professor Montero via telephone from Philadelphia Friday. We're supposed to be discussing public policy, and there are certainly enough needs to go around that could be on the table, and instead we have this going on. What's the deal?
Well, I think that's only part of the picture. But I think what it all leads back to is the fact that the black vote will decide who will be the Democratic Party nominee. And that's not just for South Carolina and the South. It's also for places like Pennsylvania, where the Philadelphia black vote is going to be really critical. And so this is kind of the start, the real beginning of the primary within the Democratic Party. And while I am not one who sees the Democratic Party as the vehicle for radical change and the type of change we need in this moment, this time in history, I do see the Bernie Sanders phenomenon as having meaning beyond the Democratic Party. And the reason I say that is that the struggle within the Democratic Party is really a struggle between the people generally and the oligarchs, the 1%, the plutocrats, and the neoliberal politicians. And so even a partial victory for Bernie Sanders is a victory in a long struggle going forward. Now, the other thing, the final thing is, many of the supporters of Bernie Sanders, if he does not get the nomination, will not vote for either the Democrats or the Republicans. So there's a lot going on here. The future of the Democratic Party in terms of black support for it is on the line. Even going forward a year or two ahead, we might see calls coming from within the black community and the wider progressive community for another political party to challenge both of the parties of the 1%.
Do you see any third party, quote unquote, poised to step into that?
Not yet. Not yet. We don't have anything close to it right now. But, you know, you just can't tell. I mean, you know, young people are now involved, and they have energy. They are, you know, many times the victims of the policies of the Clintons and the Obamas and the Republicans. So you just can't tell right now. I see the possibility. You know, we just had a conference here in Philadelphia that drew over 2,000 people, mainly young people, around the issue of the black radical tradition. If that was possible here in Philadelphia in January 2016, who is to say what is possible in the next few years concerning a new party of the people?
Okay, we had President Obama in 2008. Elected the first black president, and not a typical African-American background. He's not here 8-10 generations or whatever. Actually, first-generation son of Africa. And from him we get AFRICOM and the destruction of Libya and the entrenchment of U.S. imperialism into the command and control of 35 African nations' military. What can we expect from a socialist who doesn't believe that workers should have control of the means of production?
Well, you know, Bernie Sanders is a socialist in a very narrow sense of the word. He is really a kind of New Deal Democrat. And I think from his perspective, and I'm only talking about him now, he wants to take the party back to its New Deal foundations. However, to call that socialism benefits the wider movement for socialism, because for the first time, and I don't know when, maybe since Eugene Debs was running for president, we have a broad discussion of socialism. Now, not only does Bernie Sanders not include in his socialism the nationalization of banks, the taking over of the means of production, and so on and so forth, what is really more problematic is the fact that his foreign policy is not that of what socialists have called for in the past. We have in the past associated genuine socialism with anti-imperialism, with anti-war, with a major and radical cuts in the military budget, and so on and so forth, a policy, as it were, of peaceful coexistence with the world. Bernie Sanders somehow doesn't see his way to that. Probably, were he not running in the Democratic Party and for the Democratic nomination, he would be freer to have a more progressive foreign policy outlook. But that having been said, Sanders can call himself a socialist, but the most important thing is that he is going after the 1% and the policies that have led to this growing economic and social inequality in the country. And finally, I don't remember a major party candidate speaking openly about institutional racism as Bernie Sanders did, as I heard him speak on it last night in the debate. So, you know, from a left and progressive standpoint, we have to calibrate the positives of the Bernie Sanders phenomenon while severely criticizing, so people don't have illusions, the limitations of Bernie Sanders and his outlook and his form of socialism.
I want to get to that, to what can be done to build on it. And it just, yes, in terms of further critiquing it, you mentioned Eugene Debs. Eugene Debs, of course, ran for president from prison for opposing the First World War. And his opposition to the war was based on what's at the root of the socialism that I understand, class identity in the working class with an international character, transnational character. There is one global working class. We're all members of it. That, of course, precludes imperialism. Instead, what we have with the unity of opinion, more or less, on foreign policy between Sanders, not just Clinton, but the Republicans, too, more or less, over tactics they differ, but not over strategy. You have essentially, yes, it's okay to plunder the world. When we bring it back, we want a fairer deal for the people when we divvy up the spoils. Where can that lead?
Well, you know, nothing is inevitable. I would hesitate to say that it will inevitably lead to this or the other.
Right.
See, from my standpoint, it is not only about Bernie Sanders. It is about the millions of people who are saying, I agree with what he's saying about the way wealth and income are so divided up and unequal in this society. I think that's a huge step forward. Clearly, it's not yet socialism, but the people will decide that. It creates space. This phenomenon creates space for something that we have not seen in maybe 75 or 80 years. So that is what is positive. It comes at a time when U.S. imperialism needs a secure and safe rear base. They don't need this upheaval in the rear as they move to consolidate and expand their positions globally. But Sanders is doing this phenomena, is creating that instability, that political questioning, that questioning of the legitimacy of the political process, of the politicians, of their connection to the billionaire class, and all of that type of thing. Now, he is not, let us say, advocating class struggle. But when you examine what is happening in this phenomena, what you see is the coming to the fore of the Bernie Sanders movement, not of the middle class and intellectuals, but of the working class, of the poor. And that's why this black vote in South Carolina, in Mississippi, Alabama, and as we go forward in Pennsylvania, in California, and in Ohio, and in Michigan, is going to be so decisive. Because the black vote, which usually is united on the side of the least reactionary candidates, is a working class vote. So I think that, and then of course I would add this, I mean, don't underestimate what's going on within the labor movement and the division there between the leadership and the rank and file members. Rank and file members saying we're supporting Bernie Sanders. I think, you know, the most striking in this regard is the Chicago Teachers Union and its leadership. So a lot of things are happening at the same time. Sanders himself is not the whole picture. For example, when a person like Harry Belafonte comes out, for Bernie Sanders. Now, a lot of people talking about John Lewis coming out for Hillary Clinton. Well, in my estimate, Harry Belafonte, in historical terms, is at least the equivalent of John Lewis. I think he's beyond John Lewis. Yeah. But what is Harry Belafonte supporting? He is supporting a mass uprising against the 1%.
And
so that's the way I see it, Don.
You know, back in the 30s, I mean, Franklin D. Roosevelt essentially was a phenomenon in response to the growing demands by workers, socialists, communists, and others that were mass movement at the time. In the same way, the social forces that are gathering outside of and underneath the political process, I mean, the political process here is essentially a way of managing the society. And what do you see? The fact that they had, that there's space for Sanders and space for a conversation about socialism, what does that reveal about what's happening in terms of the underlying movements in the country and the potential? Because you're talking about them being afraid of a rear guard action. What's the potential for developing that?
I think the potential is huge. And I think what we're looking at in the most immediate sense, is a process that goes back to 2011 and the Occupy movement. And, you know, the 1% just can't shake this identification of them as the 1% or the 1/10 of 1%. Right. I mean, they just can't get around that. This anti-Wall Street anger goes back to Occupy. But then it comes up through Trayvon Martin, and then Mike Brown and Eric Garner, and now this anti-police state movement. But then there are streams leading into it from the Chelsea Mannings and the Snowdens and the Assanges and those whistleblowers and those who are concerned about civil liberties and civil rights. And then, of course, this huge and growing peace movement and the environmental movement. And so I think we're seeing a convergence of forces that have not yet completely met up and said we're all in this together. But I think the more foresighted of them recognize that there are multiple things going on. And folks are saying, let it all happen. Let it all move forward. And in some ways, Bernie Sanders is a kind of vehicle for that. Now, of course, you have the liberals who are committed to the Democratic Party. For example, the editors of The Nation magazine, they endorse Bernie Sanders. But it's pretty clear to me that they don't want a third-party movement. They want a reform of the Democratic Party. But the people who will make the Bernie Sanders movement, I think, are increasingly saying both of these parties are worthless. And both of these parties are part of a two-party duopoly, of an oligarchic regime that has no space for the democratic aspirations of the majority of people.
You think there might be people looking forward from Sanders' campaign? Well, first of all, either he wins the primaries or he doesn't, or in any event, mm-hmm. either he's the nominee or he's not. Do you think that among Sanders' supporters that there are people there far-sighted enough to, for example, be lifting phone logs and voter rolls and all of the assets that the Democratic Party makes available?
Well, I really hope so. I hadn't thought about that. But that type of quote-unquote subversive activity would be very valuable.
Because the...
Because, you know, you're right about that because, you know, why would ordinary people put so much into this type of phenomenon, this type of campaign, and then if it is not successful, or even if it is successful, walk away and allow the people at the top of it, let us say, the functionaries in it, to have all of the resources that the people themselves built up? And I hope there are some people who will do that.
Mm. And finally, for the rest of us who aren't engaged directly in, say, the Sanders campaign, but are watching these social developments occur, what is it we should be working on?
Well, one thing I would say that these primaries focus upon or force us to focus upon local activism, building up coalitions and united fronts and carrying out all kinds of demonstrations, be they for jobs or against police murders and the criminal justice system or against gentrification. These local questions are very strategic and very central. So I think everyone needs to be a part of some community organization, some type of survival program, some form of political and socialist education of the masses of people. And that doesn't have to be a huge thing. It could be a small community organization, a tenants organization, a church organization. So I think we all should be grounded in some form of local organizing and resistance. The other thing is, I think the activists have to educate ourselves. It's not as though we have all the answers. You know, we're faced with an economy that even the people who run the economy don't understand. And because they don't understand the economy, they are fearful of the consequences of an economy that collapses or goes into chaos, and they're fearful of what the masses throughout the world will do, as they're doing in Greece and South Africa and many places that we seldom read about in the newspapers. So we have to educate ourselves. We have to understand the economy. We have to understand the society. And frankly, we have to understand the world, the people of the world. And then, of course, and the last thing I would say, a part of this political education is anti-nationalist, anti-white supremacist, anti-xenophobic, anti-Islamophobic, anti-all kinds of phobias about gender and sexuality. We have to begin in this process of education to create new types of people, new types of leaders, new types of imaginations of our common future.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.